art and politics would never touch. In reality, they can't keep their hands off each other. So as in all things, a politics lurks inside the story triangle. The politics of taste, the politics of festivals and awards, and most importantly, the politics of artistic versus commercial success. And as in all things political, the distortion of truth is greatest at the extremes. Each of us has a natural address somewhere on the story triangle. The danger is that for reasons more ideological than personal, you may feel compelled to leave home and work in a distant corner, trapping yourself into designing stories you don't in your heart believe. But if you take an honest look at the cinema's often specious polemics, you won't lose your way. Over the years, the primary political issue in cinema has been Hollywood film versus art film. Although the terms seem dated, their partisans are very contemporary and vocal. Traditionally, their arguments have been framed in terms of big versus low budget, special effects versus painterly composition, the star system versus ensemble acting, private finance versus government support, and auteurs versus guns for hire. Behind the political squabbling over finance, distribution, and awards lies a deep cultural divide, reflecting the opposing worldviews of the arc plot versus mini-plot and anti-plot. From story to story, the writer may move anywhere within the triangle, but most of us feel more at home in one place or the other. You must make your own political choices and decide where you reside. As you do, let me offer these points for you to weigh. First, your career. The writer must earn his living writing. A talented writer's survival in the real world of film and television, theater and publishing, begins with his recognition of this fact. As story design moves away from the arc plot and down the triangle toward the far reaches of mini-plot, anti-plot, and non-plot, the audience shrinks. This atrophy of audience has nothing to do with quality or lack of it. All three corners of the story triangle gleam with masterworks the world treasures, pieces of perfection for our imperfect world. Rather, the audience shrinks for this reason. Most human beings believe that life brings closed experiences of absolute irreversible change, that their greatest sources of conflict are external to themselves, that they are the single and active protagonist of their own existence, that their existence operates through continuous time within a consistent, causally interconnected reality, and that inside this reality, events happen for explainable and meaningful reasons. Since our first ancestor stared into a fire of his own making and thought the thought, "I am," this is how human beings have seen the world and themselves in it. Classical design is a mirror of the human mind. Classical design is a model of memory and anticipation. When we think back to the past, do we piece events together anti-structured? Minimalistically? No. We collect and shape our memories around an arc plot in order to bring back the past vividly. When we daydream about the future, what we dread or pray will happen, is our vision minimalistic? Anti-structured? No. We mold our fantasies and hopes into an arc plot. Classical design displays the temporal, spatial, and causal patterns of human perception. When the audience senses that a story is drifting too close to fictional realities it finds tedious or meaningless, it feels alienated and turns away. This is true of intelligent, sensitive people of all incomes and backgrounds. The vast majority of human beings cannot endorse the inconsistent realities of anti-plot, the internalized passivity of mini-plot, and the static circularity of non-plot as metaphors for life as they live it. As story reaches the bottom of the triangle, the audience has shrunk to those loyal, cinephile intellectuals who love to have their realities twisted once in a while. This is an enthusiastic, challenging audience, but it is also a very small audience. If you wish to write mini-plot or anti-plot, and can find a non-Hollywood producer to work at low budget, and are happy with relatively little money for yourself, good. Do it. But when you write for Hollywood, A low-budget script is no asset. If a Hollywood producer likes your work, he or she will option it and show it to A-list actors and directors, those very expensive artists whose names and reputations reassure nervous studio executives. These professionals will read your minimalist or anti-structured piece, perhaps applaud your handling of image, but decline to be involved, because experience has taught them that if the story is inconsequential, so is the audience. The producer will then abandon your work. Even modest Hollywood budgets run into tens of millions of dollars, and each film must find an audience large enough to repay its cost at a profit greater than the same money would have earned in a secured investment. Why should investors place millions at enormous jeopardy when they can put it into real estate and at least have a building when they're done, not something that's shown in a couple film festivals, shoved into a refrigerated vault, and forgotten? If a Hollywood studio is going to take this wild ride with you, you must write a film that has at least a chance of recouping its huge risk. In other words, a film that leans toward the arc plot. Second, your development as an artist. The writer must master classical form. By instinct or study, fine writers recognize that minimalism and anti-structure are not independent forms, but reactions to the classical. Mini-plot and anti-plot were born out of the arc plot. One shrinks it, the other contradicts it. Therefore, great storytellers have always known that, regardless of background or education, everyone, consciously or instinctively, enters the story ritual with classical anticipation. To make mini-plot and anti-plot work, the writer must play with or against this expectancy. Only by carefully and creatively shattering or bending the classical form can the artist lead the audience to perceive the inner life hidden in a mini-plot, or to accept the chilling absurdity of an anti-plot. But how can a writer creatively reduce or reverse that which he does not understand? Writers who have found success in the deep corners of the story triangle knew that the starting point of understanding is at the top and began their careers in the classical. Ingmar Bergman wrote and directed love stories, social and historical dramas for 20 years before he dared venture into the minimalism of The Silence or the empty structure of Persona. Fellini made Evitione and La Strada before he risked the mini-plot of Armacord or the anti-plot of 8½. Godard first made Breathless before Weekend. Robert Altman perfected his story talents in TV series Bonanza and Alfred Hitchcock Presents. First the masters mastered the arc plot. Now let's look at the relationship between the design of a story and its setting. The setting of a story is four-dimensional, two dimensions of time, two dimensions of space. Period. The first dimension of time. Is the story set in a contemporary world, a historical period, a hypothetical future? Duration. The second dimension of time. How much time does the story span within the lives of your characters? Decades, years, months, days. Location, the first dimension of space. What is the story's specific geography? In what town? On what streets? What buildings on those streets? What rooms inside those buildings? Up what mountain? Across what desert? Levels of conflict, the second dimension of space. At what level of conflict do you pitch your telling? No matter how externalized in institutions or internalized in individuals, the political, economic, ideological, biological, and psychological forces of society shape events as much as period, landscape, or costume. Therefore, the cast of characters, containing its various levels of conflict, from the subconscious mind to galactic war, is part of a story's setting. These four corners, period in time, location in space, duration through time, and the level or levels of conflict, square off the setting of your story. And the relationship between your story's event design and its setting is that the setting sharply defines and limits what is possible within the telling. Although your setting is a fiction, not everything that comes to mind may be allowed to happen in it. Within any world, no matter how fantasied, only certain events are possible or probable. At first, this principle seems negative, for creative people often resist the notion of limitations. But remember, by the time modern filmgoers sit down to your work, they've absorbed tens of thousands of hours of TV, movies, prose, and theater. What will you create that they haven't seen before? Where will you find a truly original story? How will you win the war on clichés? Cliché is at the root of audience dissatisfaction, and like a plague spread through ignorance, they now infect all story media. The cause of this worldwide epidemic is simple and clear. The writer does not know the world of his story. Knowledge of and insight into the world of your story is fundamental to the achievement of originality and excellence. Therefore, the first step toward a well-told story is to create a knowable world. Limitation is a vital stimulus to creativity. If your setting spans too much time and space, too much society, too many characters, your knowledge will be stretched thin and your event choices clichéd. Understanding this principle, all great storytellers have confined the scope of their settings to what an artist's mind could absorb in godlike depth and detail. War and Peace, although told against a landscape of Russia in turmoil, is in fact the narrowly focused tale of a handful of characters from two interrelated families. Crime and Punishment is microscopic. A small world does not mean a trivial world. Art consists of separating one tiny piece from the rest of the universe and holding it up in such a way that it appears to be the most important, fascinating thing of this moment. The smaller the world, the more complete the knowledge of the writer, therefore the greater his creative choices. Result, a fully original story and a victory in the war on cliché. Now, let's turn to the relationship of story design to story type, or genre. One of your first steps is to identify the genre, or combination of genres, governing your work. Here is a genre system used by screenwriters. It's a system that separates story types by their subjects, settings, roles, and/or values. The love story. Its subgenre, buddy salvation, substitutes friendship for romantic love, Mean Streets, Passion Fish, Romy and Michelle's high school reunion. The horror film. It has three subgenres. Supernatural, in which the source of horror is from the spirit realm, The Exorcist. Uncanny, in which the source of horror is, in some sense, scientifically explainable, Alien. And super uncanny, in which we keep the audience guessing as to which it is. For example, is the protagonist a madman, or is he haunted by demons? The Tenant, The Shining, for examples. The modern epic, in which an individual battles the state. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Spartacus, The People versus Larry Flint. The Western. The war genre. Although war is often the setting for another genre, such as the love story, the war genre is specifically about combat. The maturation plot, or coming-of-age story, Stand By Me, Risky Business, Big. The redemption plot, A Bad Guy Turns Good, The Hustler, Lord Jim, Drugstore Cowboy, Schindler's List. The punitive plot, A Good Guy Turns Bad and Is Punished, Greed, Mephisto, Wall Street, Falling Down. The testing plot, in which a character is constantly tempted to surrender his values or courage, The Old Man and the Sea, Cool Hand Luke, Forrest Gump. The education plot turns on a deep change within the protagonist's view of either life, of people or self from the negative to the positive. Harold and Maude, Tender Mercies, My Best Friend's Wedding. The disillusionment plot turns on a deep change of worldview from the positive to the negative, Mrs. Parker and the Vicious Circle. Some genres are mega-genres. Comedy, crime, social drama, action-adventure are so large and complex that they're filled with numerous sub-genre variations on the mother theme. Taking a still wider view, if you take the genres I've listed and reset them in a unique location of time, or base them on fact, or treat them with a special style of presentation, they become historical drama, biography, docudrama, mockumentary, the musical, science fiction, the sports genre, fantasy, and animation. And lastly, for those who believe that genres and their conventions are concerns of commercial writers only, and that serious art is non-generic, let me add one last name to the list, the art film, which could begin with any of the genres I've mentioned, but is now given a new convention. The story design itself must be unconventional, mini-plotted or anti-plotted. Although this slate is reasonably comprehensive, no list can ever be definitive or exhaustive, because the lines between genres often overlap as they influence and merge with one another. Yet they're firm and stable enough to be identified and worked with, much as a composer plays with the malleable movements of musical genres. A writer's homework is to first identify his genre, then research its governing practices. Each genre imposes conventions on story design. Conventional value changes at climax, such as the down ending of the disillusionment plot. Conventional settings, such as the Western. Conventional events, such as boy meets girl in the love story. Conventional roles, such as the criminal in a crime story. The audience knows these conventions and expects to see them fulfilled. Consequently, the choice of genre sharply determines and limits what's possible within a story, as its design must envision the audience's knowledge and anticipations of convention. Each genre has unique conventions, but in some, these are relatively uncomplicated and pliable. The disillusionment plot. Its primary convention is a protagonist who opens the story filled with optimism, who holds high ideals or beliefs, whose view of life is positive. Its second convention is a pattern of repeatedly negative story turns that may at first raise his hopes, but ultimately poison his dreams and values, leaving him deeply cynical and disillusioned. The protagonist of The Conversation, for example, begins with an orderly, secure hold on life and ends in paranoid nightmare. This simple set of conventions offers uncountable possibilities, for life knows a thousand paths to hopelessness. Among the many memorable films in this genre are The Misfits, La Dolce Vita, Lenny. Other genres are relatively inflexible and filled with a complex of rigid conventions. The crime genre. There must be a crime. It must happen early in the telling. There must be a detective character, professional or amateur, who discovers clues and suspects. In the subgenre of the thriller, the criminal must make it personal. Although the story may start with a cop who works for a paycheck, to deepen the drama, at some point, the criminal goes over the line. Clichés grow like fungus around this convention. The criminal menaces the family of the cop, or turns the cop himself into a suspect, or, cliché of clichés, with roots going back to the Maltese Falcon, he kills the detective's partner. Ultimately, the cop must identify, apprehend, and punish the criminal. Comedy contains myriad subgenres as well, each with its own conventions. But one overriding convention unites this mega-genre and distinguishes it from drama. Nobody gets hurt. In comedy, the audience must feel that no matter how characters bounce off walls, no matter how they scream and writhe under the whips of life, it doesn't really hurt. Buildings may fall on Laurel and Hardy, but they get up out of the rubble, dust themselves off, mutter, "Now what a fine mess," and on they go. Art films are conventionalized by a number of external practices, such as the absence of stars, production outside the Hollywood system, generally a language other than English, all of which become sales points as the marketing team encourages critics to champion the film as an underdog. But its primary internal conventions are, firstly, a celebration of the cerebral. The art film favors the intellect by smothering strong emotion under a blanket of mood, while through enigma, symbolism, and/or unresolved tensions, it invites interpretation and analysis in the post-film ritual of cafe criticism. Secondly, and essentially, the story design of an art film depends on one grand convention, unconventionality. Minimalist and/or anti-structured unconventionality is the art film's distinguishing convention. Success in the art film genre usually results in instant, although often temporary, recognition as an artist. On the other hand, the durable Alfred Hitchcock worked solely within the arc plot and genre convention, always aimed for a mass audience and habitually found it. Yet today he stands atop the pantheon of filmmakers, worshipped worldwide as one of the century's major artists, a film poet whose works resonate with sublime images of sexuality, religiosity, and subtleties of point of view. Hitchcock knew that there is no necessary contradiction between art and popular success, nor a necessary connection between art and the art film. Genre convention is a creative limitation that forces the writer's imagination to rise to the occasion. Rather than deny convention and flatten the story, a fine writer calls on conventions like old friends, knowing that in the struggle to fulfill them in a unique way, he may find inspiration for the scenes that will lift his story above the ordinary. Genres are frequently combined to resonate meaning, to enrich character, and to create varieties of mood and emotion. A love story subplot, for example, finds its way inside almost any crime story. The Fisher King wove 5 threads: redemption plot, psychodrama, love story, social drama, comedy, into an excellent film. The musical horror film was a delicious invention. Given the 24 principal genres, possibilities for inventive crossbreeding are endless. In this way, the writer in command of genre may create a type of film the world has never seen. For innovative writers are not only contemporary, they are visionary. They know that the attitudes in society and the world around us change, slowly perhaps, but evolving nonetheless. Story genres, as a result, are not static or rigid, but flexible and mutable. They're simply 24 different ways of looking at reality. As the world we see through the lens of genre changes, the width and focus of the lens, the genre and its conventions, changes with it. And so fine writers keep their ear to the wall of history. And as things change, they can sense the way society is leaning toward the future. They then produce works that break convention and take the genres into their next generation. This, for example, is one of the many beauties of Chinatown. In the climax of all previous murder mysteries, the detective was required to apprehend and punish the criminal. But Chinatown's wealthy and politically powerful killer gets away with it, breaking that honored convention. This film could not have been made, however, until the 1970s, when the Civil Rights Movement, Watergate, and the Vietnam War woke America up to the depth of its corruption, and the nation realized that indeed the rich were getting away with murder and much more. Chinatown rewrote the genre, opening the door to down-ending crime stories such as Body Heat, Crimes and Misdemeanors, Q&A, Basic Instinct, The Last Seduction, 7. Mastery of genre is essential for yet one more reason. Screenwriting is not for sprinters, but long-distance runners. No matter what you've heard about scripts dashed off over a weekend at poolside, from first inspiration to last polished draft, a quality screenplay consumes 6 months, 9 months, a year or more. Writing a film demands the same creative labor in terms of world, character, and story as a 400-page novel. The only substantive difference is the number of words used in the telling. A screenplay's painstaking economy of language demands sweat and time, while the freedom to fill pages with prose often makes writing easier, even faster. All writing is discipline, but screenwriting is a drill sergeant. Ask yourself, therefore, what will keep your desire burning over those many months? Generally, great writers tightly focus their careers on one idea, a single subject that ignites their passion, a subject that they can pursue with beautiful variation through a lifetime of work. Therefore, be honest in your choice of genre and write in the genre you love. For of all the reasons for wanting to write, the only one that nurtures us through time is love of the work itself. Next, the relationship of event design to character. Which is more important, plot or character? This debate is as old as the art and specious. We cannot ask which is more important, structure or character, because they're the same thing. Structure is character. Character is structure. One cannot be more important than the other. Yet the argument goes on due to a widely held confusion over two crucial aspects of the fictional role, the difference between character and characterization. Characterization is the sum of all observable qualities of a human being, everything knowable through careful scrutiny, age and IQ, sex and sexuality, style of speech and gesture, choices of home, car and dress, education and occupation, personality and nervosity, values and attitudes. This assemblage of traits is characterization, and done well makes the role unique. But it is not character. True character is expressed in choices under pressure. Deep inside, despite characterization, despite appearances, who is this person really? Is he or she fundamentally honest or a liar? Loving or cruel? Courageous or cowardly? Wise or foolish? Loyal or traitorous? Strong or weak? The only way we come to know characters in depth, to know the truth of who they are, is to witness them make choices under pressure, to take one action or another in the pursuit of their desires. How they choose is who they are. This revelation of true character, in contrast or contradiction to characterization, is fundamental to all fine storytelling. Life teaches this grand principle. What seems is not what is. People are not what they appear to be. When characterization and true character match, when inner life and outer appearance are like a block of cement of one substance, the role becomes a list of repetitious, predictable behaviors. For example, what went wrong with Rambo? In First Blood, he was a compelling character, a Vietnam burnout, a loner hiking through the mountains seeking solitude. Then a sheriff, for no reason other than wickedly high levels of testosterone, provoked him, and out came Rambo, a ruthless and unstoppable killer. But once Rambo came out, he wouldn't go back in. For the sequels, he strapped bandoliers of bullets across his oiled, pumped muscles, coiffed his locks with a red bandana, until superhero characterization and true character merged into a figure with less dimension than a Saturday morning cartoon. Compare that flat pattern to James Bond. 3 seems to be the limit on Rambos, but there's been nearly 20 Bond films. Bond goes on and on because the world delights in the repeated revelation of a deep character that contradicts characterization. Bond enjoys playing the lounge lizard. Dressed in a tuxedo, he graces posh parties, a cocktail glass dangling off his fingertips as he chats up beautiful women. But then story pressure builds, and Bond's choices reveal that underneath this lounge lizard exterior is a thinking man's Rambo. This exposé of witty superhero, in contradiction to playboy characterization, has become a seemingly endless pleasure. Taking the principle further, the revelation of deep character, in contrast or contradiction to characterization, is not only fundamental, but minimal in major characters. Minor roles may or may not need hidden dimensions, but principles must be written in depth. They cannot be at heart what they seem to be at face. And taking the principle further yet, the finest of writing not only reveals true character, but arcs or changes that inner nature, for better or worse, over the course of the telling. This is the play between character and structure seen throughout the history of fiction. First, the story introduces the protagonist's characterization. Home from the university for the funeral of his father, Hamlet has discovered that his uncle has seized the throne and married his mother. Melancholy and confused, Hamlet wishes he were dead. Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt. Second, we're soon led into the heart of the character. His true nature is revealed as he chooses to take one action over another. The ghost of Hamlet's father claims he was murdered by his brother, Hamlet's uncle. The prince's choices expose a highly intelligent and cautious nature, restraining a passionate immaturity. He decides to seek revenge, but not until he can prove the king's guilt. I will speak daggers, but use none. Third, this deep nature is at odds with the outer countenance of the character, contrasting with it, if not contradicting it. We sense that he is not what he appears to be. Hamlet is not merely sad, sensitive, and cautious. Other qualities wait hidden behind his persona. Hamlet, I am but mad north-northwest, and when the wind is southerly, I know a hawk from a handsaw. Fourth, to expose the character's inner nature more profoundly, the story puts greater and greater pressure on him, forcing him to make more and more difficult choices. Hamlet hunts for his father's killer and finds him on his knees in prayer. He could easily kill his uncle now, but Hamlet realizes that if Claudius dies in prayer, his soul might go to heaven. So Hamlet forces himself to wait and kill Claudius when the king's soul is as damned and black as hell whereto it goes. Fifth, by the climax of the story, these choices have profoundly changed the humanity of the character. Hamlet's inner wars, known and unknown, come to an end. His rash impulses reach a peaceful maturity. His lively intelligence ripens into wisdom. The rest is silence. The function of structure is to provide progressively building pressure that forces characters into more and more difficult dilemmas, where they must make more and more difficult risk-taking choices and actions, gradually revealing their true natures, even down to the unconscious self. The function of character is to provide the story with the necessary qualities of characterization to convincingly act out these choices. Simply put, a character must be credible. Young enough or old enough, worldly or naive, educated or ignorant, witty or dull, generous or selfish, in the right proportions, to allow the audience to believe in his or her choices and actions. Plot, as Aristotle noted, is more important than characterization, and any aspect of characterization that undermines the credibility of an action must be sacrificed. But story structure and true character are interlocked, one phenomenon seen from two points of view. The choices that characters make from behind their outer masks simultaneously shape their inner natures and propel the story. From Oedipus Rex to Falstaff, from Zorba the Greek to Thelma and Louise, this is the character structure dynamic of consummate storytelling. Now, let's examine the relationship of story to meaning. Like music and dance, painting and sculpture, poetry and song, story is first, last, and always the experience of aesthetic emotion, the simultaneous encounter of thought and feeling. When an idea wraps itself round an emotional charge, it becomes all the more powerful, all the more profound, all the more memorable. We might forget the day we saw a dead body in the street. But the death of Hamlet haunts us forever. Life on its own, without art to shape it, leaves us in confusion and chaos. But aesthetic emotion harmonizes what we know with what we feel to give us a heightened awareness and a sureness of our place in reality. In short, a story well told gives us the very thing we rarely get from life, meaningful emotional experience. Two ideas bracket the creative process. Premise, the idea that inspires the writer's desire to create a story, and controlling idea, the story's ultimate meaning expressed through the action and aesthetic emotion of the last act's climax. A premise is not a closed statement, but an open-ended question. What would happen if? What would happen if a shark devoured a vacationer? Jaws. What would happen if a wife walked out on her husband and child? Kramer versus Kramer. Stanislavski, the renowned acting teacher, called this the magic if, the daydreamy hypothetical that floats through the mind, opening the door to the imagination where everything and anything seems possible. The controlling idea, on the other hand, names a story's root or central idea, its final meaning. But the term also implies function. The controlling idea helps shape or control the writer's strategic choices. The more ideas you try to pack into a story, the more they implode upon themselves, until the film collapses into a rubble of tangential notions saying nothing. Conversely, the more beautifully you shape your work around one clear idea, the more meanings the audience will discover in your film as they take your idea and follow its implications into every aspect of their lives. A controlling idea is a single-sentence statement describing how and why life undergoes change. This sentence has two components, value plus cause. It identifies the positive or negative charge of the story's critical value at the last act's climax, and it states the chief reason why this value has changed to its final state. For example, in the heat of the night, justice is restored because a perceptive black outsider sees the truth of white perversion. Groundhog Day. Happiness fills our lives when we learn to love unconditionally. Nixon. The most powerful of men can be destroyed by a blind, arrogant trust in political power. How do you find your story's controlling idea? By examining the climax of the last act. In other words, the story tells you its meaning. You do not dictate meaning to the story. Your premise may start the writing somewhere in what will become the middle, or the beginning, or even near the end of the telling. But as your world and characters grow, events interlink and the story builds. Then comes that crucial moment when you take the greatest creative leap of all and fashion the story climax, a final action that moves you and that feels complete and satisfying. Your controlling idea is now at hand. Looking at your ending, ask, as a result of this last action, what value, positively or negatively charged, is brought into the lives of my characters? Next, tracing backward from this climax to the first scenes, digging to bedrock, ask, what is the chief cause or force or means that brings this value into the world? The sentence you compose from the answers to those two questions, value plus cause, becomes your controlling idea. In other words, you discover your controlling idea in the action you have created, not by designing actions to fit your preconceived ideas. Paddy Chayefsky once told me that when he finally figured out what his story was about, he'd write it out in one sentence and scotch tape it to his typewriter so that nothing going through the machine wouldn't in one way or another express the central theme. By finally figured out, Chayefsky meant the discovery of his story's meaning out of the last act climax. by wouldn't in one way or another express the central theme, he meant he'd forge the story dynamically, moving it back and forth across the opposing charges of his primary values. In other words, he fashioned his stories by playing idea against counter-idea. As a story moves from its premise to the story climax and its controlling idea, the telling is built out of two ideas, not one. Idea and counter-idea, the positive and negative expression of the same meaning. If, for example, it were a film in the crime genre, the value at stake, of course, would be justice. The meaning of its scenes or sequences will alternate between a positive idea such as justice will prevail because the protagonist is tenaciously resourceful and courageous as the detective moves ever closer to solving the crime, and a negative counter idea such as injustice will triumph because the antagonist is overwhelmingly ruthless and powerful as the criminal manages to elude or do worse to the protagonist. Whichever of the two is dramatized in the story climax becomes the controlling idea of value plus cause, the purest statement of the story's conclusive and decisive meaning. This rhythm of idea versus counter-idea is fundamental and essential to our art. It pulses at the heart of all fine stories, no matter how internalized the action. What's more, this simple dynamic can become very complex, subtle, and ironic. In Sea of Love, Detective Keller falls in love with his chief suspect. As a result, each scene that points toward her guilt turns with irony, positive on the value of justice, negative on the value of love. In the maturation plot, Shine, David's musical victories, positive, provoke his father's envy and brutal repression, negative, driving the pianist into a pathological immaturity, doubly negative, which makes his final success a triumph of maturity in both art and spirit, doubly positive. Writers and the stories they tell can be usefully divided into three grand categories according to their controlling ideas. Upending stories expressing the optimism, hopes, and dreams of mankind, a positively charged vision of the human spirit, life as we wish it to be. For example, love fills our lives when we conquer intellectual illusions and follow our instincts. Hannah and her sisters. The pessimistic, down-ending stories expressing our cynicism, our sense of loss and misfortune, a negatively charged vision of civilization's decline, of humanity's dark dimensions, life as we dread it to be, but know it so often is. Evil triumphs because it's a part of human nature. Chinatown. The ironic, up-down ending stories expressing our sense of the complex dual nature of existence, a simultaneously charged positive and negative vision, life at its most complete and realistic. Here, optimism, idealism, and pessimism, cynicism, merge and result in an ironic controlling idea. Love is both pleasure and pain, a poignant anguish, a tender cruelty we pursue because without it life has no meaning. Annie Hall, Manhattan, Addicted to Love. The effect of irony on an audience is that wonderful reaction, ah, life is just like that. We recognize that idealism and pessimism are at the extremes of experience, that life is rarely all sunshine and strawberries, nor is it all doom and dreck. It is both. From the worst of human experiences, something positive can be gained. For the richest of human experiences, a great price must be paid. No matter how we try to plot a straight passage through life, we sail on the tides of irony. Reality is relentlessly ironic, and this is why stories that end in irony tend to last the longest through time, travel the widest in the world, and draw the greatest love and respect from audiences. This is also why, of the three possible emotional charges at climax, irony is by far the most difficult to write. It demands the deepest wisdom and the highest craft for three reasons. First, it's tough enough to come up with either a bright, idealistic ending or a sober, pessimistic ending that's satisfying and convincing. But an ironic climax is a single action that makes both a positive and negative statement. How to express both in one action. Second, how to say both clearly. Irony doesn't mean ambiguity. Ambiguity is a blur. One thing cannot be distinguished from another. But there's nothing ambiguous about irony. It's a clear double declaration of what's gained and what's lost side by side. Nor does irony mean coincidence. A true irony is honestly motivated. Stories that end by random chance, doubly charged or not, are meaningless, not ironic. Third, if at climax the life situation of the protagonist is both positive and negative, how to express it so that the two charges remain separated in the audience's experience and don't cancel each other out and you end up saying nothing? Once you discover your controlling idea, take it seriously and respect it. Never allow yourself the luxury of thinking it's just entertainment. Whether it be The Wizard of Oz or La Dolce Vita, nothing we do is innocent. All coherent stories express an idea veiled inside an emotional spell. In 388 BC, Plato urged the city fathers of Athens to exile all poets and storytellers. They are a threat to society, he argued. Writers deal with ideas, but not in the open, rational manner of philosophers. Instead, they wrap their ideas inside the powerful emotions of art. Yet, felt ideas, as Plato pointed out, are ideas nonetheless. Every effective story sends a charged idea out to us, in effect compelling the idea into us, so that we must believe. In fact, the persuasive power of a story is so great that we may believe its meaning even when we find it morally repellent. Given stories' power to influence, we cannot ignore the issue of the artist's social responsibility. I believe we have no responsibility to cure social ills or renew faith in humanity, to uplift the spirits of society, or even express our inner being. We have only one responsibility, to tell the truth. Therefore, study the climax of your last act and extract from it your controlling idea. But before you take another step, ask yourself this question. Is this the truth? Do I believe in the meaning of my story? If the answer is no, trash it and start again. If yes, do everything possible to get your work into the world. For although an artist may, in his private life, lie to others, even to himself, when he creates, he tells the truth. And in a world of lies and liars, an honest work of art is always an act of social responsibility. What is the substance of story? In all other arts, the answer is self-evident. The composer has his instrument and the notes it sounds. The dancer calls her body her instrument. Sculptors chisel stone. Painters stir paint. All artists can lay hands on the raw material of their art except the writer. For at the nucleus of a story is a substance, like the energy swirling in an atom, that's never directly seen, heard, or touched, yet we know it and feel it. The stuff of story is alive, but intangible. Intangible, I hear you thinking. But I have my words, dialogue, description. I can put hands on my pages. The writer's raw material is language. But in fact, language is not the stuff of story. To understand story's substance and how it performs, you need to view your work from the inside out, from the center of your character, looking out at the world through the character's eyes, experiencing the story as if you were the living character yourself. In order to slip into this subjective point of view, you need to look closely at the creature you intend to inhabit, a character, or, more specifically, a protagonist. The number and variety of protagonists is unlimited. Generally, the protagonist is a single character. But from Thelma and Louise to the Seven Samurai to the Dirty Dozen, two or more characters may form a plural protagonist. If so, two conditions must be met. First, for all individuals in the group to fill the role of protagonist, all must share the same desire. Second, in the struggle to achieve this desire, they must suffer and benefit mutually. A story may, on the other hand, be multi-protagonist. Here, unlike the plural protagonist, characters pursue separate and individual desires, suffering and benefiting independently. Pulp Fiction, Hannah and Her Sisters, Diner. The protagonist need not be human. It may be an animal, Babe, or a cartoon, Bugs Bunny, or even an inanimate object, such as the hero of the children's story, The Little Train That Could. Anything that can be given a free will, the capacity to desire, to take action and suffer the consequences, can be a protagonist. It's even possible, in rare cases, to switch protagonists halfway through a story. Psycho does this, making the shower murder both an emotional and formal jolt. With the protagonist dead, the audience is momentarily confused. Who is this story about? The answer is a plural protagonist, as the victim's sister, boyfriend, and a private detective take over the story. But no matter whether the story's protagonist is single, multi, or plural, no matter how he or she is characterized, all protagonists have certain hallmark qualities, and the first is willpower. Other characters may be dogged, even rigid, but the protagonist in particular is a willful being, determined enough to sustain desire through conflict and ultimately take an action that creates meaningful and irreversible change. What's more, the true strength of the protagonist's will may hide behind a passive characterization. Consider Blanche DuBois, protagonist of A Streetcar Named Desire. At first glance, she seems weak, drifting, and will-less, only wanting, she says, to live in reality. Yet beneath her frail characterization, Blanche's deep character owns a powerful will that drives her unconscious desire. What she really wants is to escape from reality. So Blanche does everything she can to buffer herself against the ugly world that engulfs her. She acts the grande dame, puts doilies on frayed furniture, lampshades on naked light bulbs, tries to make a Prince Charming out of a dullard. When none of these succeed, she takes the final escape from reality. She goes